Max, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Welcome to the show at WSJU Radio, St. John's University. Mad Max on the airways with the legendary Bob Costas. Bob Costas, how are you doing?
Not too bad. Hanging in there.
What are your expectations for this upcoming MLB season, which actually starts today? And if you're a Mets fan, it's actually postponed due to COVID-19 issues already.
Well, I think that's one of the stories, COVID-19. How well can they navigate it? It's obvious some progress has been made. It also should be obvious that it's not case closed yet. There are still some hurdles to clear. So on the one hand, you're going to have, in all likelihood, some COVID interruptions. They may not be as severe as they were a year ago. I'm not talking about the fact that it was obviously very severe that they were only able to play 60 games. Mm-hmm. But even within those 60 games, you had interruptions with the Marlins and with the Cardinals. It's unlikely that it would reach that extent. But as we see on opening day, there was some positive test. And so the Mets and Nats had to be postponed. There's going to be some of that. How they navigate that will be interesting. I think they did, all things considered, a very good job last year. They hit some speed bumps, but they never drove into a ditch, and they got all the way through their bubble World Series. And now they're back in their own ballparks with limited attendance, except for Texas, where the Rangers say that they'll welcome everybody in. If every seat is filled, it's okay with them. But most are playing to somewhere between 20 and 30% capacity. And how that works out is going to be interesting. So those issues are going to be there, along with the normal opening day questions and speculations about which teams improve themselves most and which are at a crossroads, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. You were born in Queens and you attended Syracuse University. Why was Syracuse your choice to go to college?
Well, even then, Syracuse had quite a reputation, mm-hmm. not just in journalism, but what was then an emerging field of academic study, which was broadcast journalism. Mm-hmm. And I read in a Nick yearbook as a kid growing up on Long Island that both Marty Glickman, the original voice of the Knicks, and really the guy who invented how to call basketball on the radio, all the terminology and the casing and whatnot, he's really the godfather of it, that both Marty Glickman and his protege and ultimate successor, Marv Albert, had gone to Syracuse. And I later learned that others, not necessarily in sports, Ted Koppel, Dick Clark, and other sports broadcasters who preceded me, Len Berman preceded me by a little, Andy Musser, who was a big deal broadcaster in Philadelphia, sports broadcaster, that they had all gone to Syracuse. So that, coupled with the fact that they played big-time sports at the collegiate level, mm-hmm. and if you wanted to be a sports broadcaster, you hope to have some games worthy of interest to broadcast on the campus station. So those were the reasons I went. And I guess I was part of the next wave, where eventually that reputation became so widespread that a huge percentage of talented young people who aspired to be sports broadcasters wanted to go to Syracuse. And now that list is almost too long
yes.
to rattle through. So I'm proud to be a small part of that lineage.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been to St. John's before, being from New York and Queens especially?
Yes. I've been to the campus once or twice to speak to students. I've also been to Fordham. I remember when I was at Syracuse, and we used to travel to do the Syracuse basketball games. I did a game or two at St. John's and at least one at Fordham, and remember doing games on the campus station when St. John's and Fordham were the opponents. This was before the formation of the Big East, mm-hmm. which has since come and gone. Syracuse was an independent then, and by my recollection, so too were St. John's and Fordham, but they did play each other, if only because of geographic proximity.
I'd love to hear about your journey from your time in college to NBC Sports and how WAER and the program at Syracuse set you up for the business.
Yeah, it really did, because the students there were able to try their hand at it almost right away. I did my first broadcast on WAER a month into my freshman year. Mm. Now, we were all pretty bad at the beginning, but at least you got a chance to figure out if you had any knack for it. And if you did, you got many opportunities to polish it. And that was really as important as anything I learned in a classroom, although part of it also was that if you were lucky enough to catch the eye of a professor who thought that you had some potential, Then you got that guidance from the academic side, and you were also surrounded by like-minded young people who shared your interests. And so that atmosphere, not just in the classroom, but at WAER and at the campus television facilities, which they also let the kids try their hand at, that atmosphere, we critique each other, the mutual enthusiasm could be felt. It's hard to quantify that, but that was part of the experience as much as what your grade point average was.
Yeah, that was definitely important. If you even talk to Ian Eagle, Syracuse played such an important role for people such as yourself in your careers in broadcasting. But if you could pinpoint, what was the most important Emmy that you won throughout your career, the most important one that you value to yourself?
Well, in terms of what it meant to me personally, the first one. Back then, the categories of play-by-play and hosting were combined. And it was either 1986 or 87 that I won my first one. A few years after that, they separated them, and it became play-by-play as a separate category, and hosting was also in its own category. And I was nominated and won at various times in each of them, but the majority of them were for the hosting category. But at the beginning, it was a combination. So you submitted a tape, in some cases, depending upon who you were, was entirely play-by-play or entirely hosting, but mine was a combination of the two, which probably helped me. And in the 80s, the sports Emmys were televised, usually on some independent station, syndicated, and they were hosted by entertainment figures. Alan Thicke was the host, and I'm trying to remember who the co-host was, but there were various entertainment figures. Robert Klein, the comedian, was one of the presenters. So the thing was televised, and everybody wore tuxedos and evening attire for the women. So it had a certain glamour attached to it, and they rattled off the nominees. It was like a miniature, you know, entertainment Emmy thing, or further miniature Oscar thing. I was a big thrill when I heard my name announced. Others in the category, I guess, like Dick Enberg and Al Michaels, people that I really looked up to, and somehow I managed to win that first time in 1986 or 87, so I'm 34, 35 years old. Whatever came subsequently, I guess that one would always be the biggest thrill.
And then it just led you right to the 28th. Eventually, you have more Emmys than the Yankees have World Series. And speaking of Yankees, you even had a legendary interview with Mickey Mantle. Would you say that the most challenging event or something that you did in your career was giving the eulogy at Mickey Mantle's funeral because of just all the pressure that you may have had on yourself? Everyone, the attention was all on you at that point, from the, not only the sports world, but media all over.
Well, I felt a responsibility to his family as well. There was a little bit of a needle to thread there, because you had to acknowledge, as Mickey did himself, you had to acknowledge the flaws and regrets in his life. But at the same time, you had to capture or attempt to capture why he meant so much to people, not just as a baseball star, which was part of it, but also on a personal level. Why those who knew him, most of them, felt such an attachment to him and such a fondness for him. And so I knew I was speaking not just for myself, but for an entire generation or more of baseball fans, not just Yankee fans, but people who love the game and who grew up in the 50s and 60s, and Mickey Mantle was one of the symbols of baseball and what it meant in that era, which was different than 1995, which was when I delivered that eulogy. And at the same time, I'm addressing the people in the church, many of whom were his teammates or those who were directly connected to him through baseball, and others were just baseball fans. And then, of course, the family was there. Very honestly, Max, I was unaware. I don't know why I was unaware, but I truly did not understand that it was being televised live in its entirety.
Wow.
Up in the balcony of the church, I saw television cameras, but I took them to be local news, and they'd use a clip or something of it on the 6 o'clock news, something like that. I had no idea that ESPN was carrying it live, the entire service, not just my eulogy, the entire service, and that it was being carried live in New York because of Mantle's obvious standing in New York as opposed to other parts of the country. And because of that, the reaction to it was much greater than anything I could have anticipated. Back then, people still wrote letters, which they tend not to do now. And I got like 7,000 or 8,000 letters about the eulogy, and people that just wanted to share their baseball memories of growing up, and whether it was Mantle or somebody else being their favorite player. So I guess it touched a chord with people, and I hope I did justice to it.
I definitely think you did. Who's someone that you haven't interviewed throughout your career, and you've interviewed a lot of people, that you would love to interview?
Well, you know, kind of the holy grail for baseball people is Sandy Koufax, and it's never going to happen. And I admire Sandy for that. He not only was an elegant pitcher, he's an elegant and classy person. Mm-hmm. And he's naturally shy, and he sees no particular upside in him opening up and talking about all the things that people are curious about. There are some that might want to ask personal questions, but even those that are only interested in his baseball career and his baseball insights, I guess he figures, once I open the door too wide, then how do I close it again? And in the past, and it's been a long time since I've asked him, but in the past when I asked him, he always responded to me personally. He always called me and explained, if I was ever going to do it, Bob, I'd do it with you. And then I came to understand that meant I was at the front of a line that was never going to move. So being first in that line was no different than being 50th in that line. And when I crossed paths with Sandy, like at Cooperstown, he comes back with all the old timers each summer that they're able to have the ceremony. We always have a very cordial conversation. But Sandy would be somebody who people would say, wow, I really want to hear what he has to say. But I respect the fact that he just doesn't want to go there. Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it does happen for you. I know you said that it probably won't. But what would you say was the most challenging interview throughout your career? Because I've seen the ones with Vince McMahon, and it tends to seem as though that there are people out there that try to control the interviews. And that just goes to show you how great of an interviewer that you are, because you're keeping them on point and your facts are credible.
Well, thank you. I'll back up one moment, lest somebody in your audience say, hey, has Bob forgotten about this? There was one time relatively recently, 5 or 6 years ago, whenever the All-Star game was held in Cincinnati, and they named the four greatest living players. It was Johnny Bench, Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, and Koufax. And I called Sandy, and I said, Sandy, would you do an interview with your fellow honorees? It will be the four of you, and it will just be about your era in baseball and your mutual recollections. And on that basis, he said yes, because the focus wasn't entirely on him. Mm-hmm. And he was wonderful in that context. And the way he related to the other guys, that's what made it. It was one of the easiest interviews ever, because I just had to tee it up, and then they started talking to each other, and I just got out of the way and listened. So there was that, but that was different than the kind of interview you were asking about. Now, to your question, there are so many different kinds of interviews that it's hard to say this one is the best or this one's the most challenging. But the McMahon interview presented a certain kind of challenge because, as you imply, he was used to not only controlling interviews, but scripting them.
Yep.
Everything in his wrestling world was scripted. He played a character. He didn't like being confronted with journalistic questions, pertinent questions, along with follow-up, skeptical questions. And I wasn't alone in receiving the kind of resentment that he showed on the air. He did it to a very good reporter, Armin Katayan, who was doing a piece, I don't know, for 60 Minutes or ESPN, I forget which it was. But in any case, he slapped the notes out of Armin's hand. So, wow. You know, I think sometimes the line between Vince McMahon, the actual person, and Mr. McMahon, the wrestling character, is blurred for Vince. But he became very angry on this HBO interview. It's HBO, so it was live. There were no commercials. It was scheduled for 15 minutes, and I think we went closer to half an hour because Ross Greenberg, the producer, kept saying in my ear, keep going, keep going. And so I did, and I think I've said this before, if you were to read a transcript of the interview, I think McMahon, given the position he had to defend, did pretty well. He's a smart guy. But very often the impression that people take away from something on television is based on tone. And he lost his composure and I didn't. So on that basis, I think I did pretty well. Of course, in the wrestling world, and people who follow wrestling with some sort of irrational passion, some of those people think he prevailed simply because he was the loudest. But I think that thoughtful people evaluate things in a different way than that.
I want to go to 1989 when you were able to host or co-host with Tom Seaver in the National League Championship Series, Game 2.
Well, what happened there, Tony Kubek and I were doing the American League Championship Series, Toronto and the A's, and the first two games were in Oakland. So we fly to Toronto, and there's an off day between Games 2 and 3 in that series, which happens to be the date of Game 2 between the Giants and the Cubs at Wrigley Field in the National League Championship Series. And Vin Scully, with Tom Seaver, had called Game 1, and then he comes down with laryngitis. So Mike Weissman, who ran NBC Sports, calls me and says, "You got to get to Chicago. Vin can't do the game tonight." Well, luckily, there were enough flights from Toronto to Chicago, and it's not that far. So when I got that call, it was probably late morning. So I'm on a, 2 o'clock flight, something like that, to Chicago. And I go straight, I don't go to the hotel, I go straight to Wrigley Field. Luckily, that was the days of the game of the week on NBC. So I was very familiar with both the Giants and the Cubs, especially the Cubs, because they'd appeared frequently during the course of the season. And of course, I followed baseball closely. So I had that level of season-long preparation and historical knowledge of both teams, but I hadn't prepared to do the game in the way you normally would if you knew that was your assignment that day. So I get there. I quickly fill out a lineup card. Seaver was terrific. And I just went kind of off the cuff, and it turned out pretty well. And then with an off day the next day between the second and third games of that series, Vin was fit and ready to go by the time the series got back to San Francisco. And I flew the next morning back to Toronto and did game 3 of that series that night with Tony Kubek.
Definitely. And one of your most legendary calls came from 1984 with Sandberg with the Cubs when he had the 2 home run, especially in the 10th inning, which led them to the Cubs beating the Cardinals in the 11th inning. That was a big time call for you.
Well, I guess it was probably the first time, although I began doing games a handful in the early 80s for NBC on the Saturday game of the week, and then was paired with Tony Kubek beginning in 1983. I think maybe that game was the first one that brought me serious national attention, and I hope that I did a good job with it, but mostly it's because the game itself was so epic and remains legendary, and the key to that, especially for younger people, is to try to understand what the television landscape for baseball was then. The Saturday afternoon game of the week really was the game of the week for the vast majority of the nation. It might have been the only televised game available to them. A few years before that, the superstations in Atlanta and in Chicago had sprung up. And so some portion of the country that had cable, which was in its infancy then, could follow the Braves or the Cubs. But the Saturday afternoon game of the week was still a very big deal. The players themselves used to call it the game of the world. If they saw Vin Scully or Joe Garagiola or me and Tony Kubek at the batting cage on Friday trying to pick up some tidbits and prepare for the next afternoon's game, they'd say, "Oh, we're the game of the world tomorrow." So there was that kind of focus. And the ratings of those games were sometimes as high as World Series games get now, because there wasn't the glut of baseball out there. So it's on that stage that this game between the Cardinals and Cubs is played. And the setting matters. It's a beautiful Saturday afternoon at Wrigley Field. It's the Cardinals and the Cubs, long-standing rivalry. Anytime they play at Wrigley, you see some red shirts in the stands. Anytime they play at Busch Stadium, you see blue and Cub fans in the stands. So it has that kind of texture and atmosphere. The Cardinals jump out in front, 9-3. And the Cubs rally back, and they're within a run coming up in the bottom of the ninth. It's 9-8. The cast of characters matters. Whitey Herzog is in the Cardinal dugout, Hall of Fame manager, and a big personality that put his stamp on the team. Ozzie Smith, Willie McGee, and who's on the mound trying to close it out for the Cardinals? Bruce Sutter, former Cub, who winds up in the Hall of Fame himself, and then the premier closer in baseball. They also used relievers differently then. Herzog brought Sutter in with two outs, as I remember, in the seventh, and that wasn't all that unusual. They did that with Raleigh Fingers. They did that with Goose Gossett. They didn't just save guys for the ninth. So Suter's on the mound. It's in his second or beginning of his third inning of work. Up comes Sandberg, homers to tie the game. All right, now it's 9-9. They go to the 10th. Willie McGee doubles homer run and then scores an insurance run himself, and the double gives him the cycle. So at that point, Willie McGee is really the player of the game. He's got a single, a double, a triple, and a home run. Ozzie Smith has made a bunch of eye-popping plays. There's all kinds of stuff going on in this game. And then they go to the bottom of the 10th, and Sutter is still on the mound. Two outs, nobody on. Bob Dernier draws a walk on a 3-2 pitch, and look who comes up again. It's Sandberg. And he homers again off Sutter, almost to the exact same spot in the left center field bleachers. And now Wrigley Field on this beautiful, idyllic, perfect baseball Saturday afternoon is going nuts. And the game goes on to the 11th. And eventually the Cubs win it on a base hit over a drawn-in infield by a little-known utility player and maybe the last guy they had on their bench named Dave Owen. Now, during the course of this game, it takes on such dramatic dimensions that I said, as Sandberg came into the dugout after the second home run, maybe we're looking at the real Roy Hobbs here. This is 1984, and the movie The Natural with Robert Redford starring as Roy Hobbs had just been released only a few months before. So that was in everybody's frame of reference. And maybe what Ryan Sandberg has done here is so cinematic and so dramatic that maybe for this one Saturday, he's the real Roy Hobbs. And that was the game that marked Sandberg in the national mind as a candidate for MVP. That was his moment of emerging as a national figure. It is the signature moment of what turned out to be a Hall of Fame career. And in fact, Ryan Sandberg became the 1984 National League MVP. So you had all the elements come together. And my call was only a small factor, but it was one of them in why that game resonates so many years after.
You're exactly right. Another sensational call that you had was in 1998 when Michael Jordan scored in the fourth quarter of his finals against the Utah Jazz, which was actually the last finals for Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson for the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah, another Chicago moment.
Yes.
And here's one where, unlike the Sandberg game, where you knew that the atmosphere made it special, so you're kind of locked into what a Cardinal-Cub game on a Saturday afternoon is about, even if it doesn't turn out to be as memorable as that one. But in the case of the Bulls in 98, you had a storyline that was developing that was clear to everyone. Is this last dance? Is this the end of the Chicago Bulls as we have known them, and of Michael Jordan, arguably the greatest player in NBA history? Is this the finale? So we knew that. In addition, it's a close and competitive NBA final. The Jazz won Game 5, denying the Bulls a chance to close it out on their home floor. Now they're back in Salt Lake City, and if the Jazz win Game 6, they're going to have Game 7 on their home floor. So this is a competition, not a coronation. It isn't a foregone conclusion that the Bulls are going to win. So even if this was just an NBA final, and you didn't have all the backstory of Jordan and the Bulls, it was just an NBA final between two teams that had never won the championship, it would be an exciting final on its own merits. And the sixth game was close right to the end. But what you had to be mindful of, and I was that there was a bigger story here. There was a story that was going to be in Time and Newsweek and on the front pages of newspapers, not just in Sports Illustrated or in the sports sections, because Michael Jordan was a transcendent public pop culture figure. So because of that, you had to keep all that in mind. And as it turned out, It's Jordan who makes the big plays in the last minute or so of the game. It's Jordan who hits the classic jump shot that turns a one-point deficit into a one-point win and winds up winning the championship. So you've got to stay on top of what's happening in the game. You've got to stay on top of the strategy. And, of course, Isaiah Thomas and Doug Collins did their part with that. But then I also thought, as part of that call, in the moment, you had to frame it as maybe this is the last image of Michael Jordan. Maybe this is the way the curtain comes down on one of the greatest careers in the history of American sports. And if it is, could you possibly write a more perfect script? And, you know, now it's been 23 years since that happened. And what we said in that moment, and not just what we said, but the way NBC produced it, the replays, the framing, the way it was produced and directed, captured that moment in a way that still plays well more than two decades later.
And if you watched the Last Dance documentary, which I'm sure you did, they said that they could have won a seventh one. I think they could have. If the team stuck together.
Maybe they could have. Maybe. But they were running on fumes for the end. And I think the story is better this way. Could they have won a seventh? Certainly they would have had a chance. They would have been in contention for it. But if they had kept going until it was taken from them on the court, then the last image of Michael Jordan and those Chicago Bulls would have been them walking off the court in defeat. I think it's better now that this is the last image. Six is enough. Would it really have enhanced it any if it was seven or even eight? I don't think it would have made that much of a difference. Plus, the scenario was very unlikely to be as good. Maybe they would have won. Let's say they won a seven. Mm-hmm. Would they have won it in just that fashion, in that kind of theatrical fashion? Probably not. So I think the story is better the way it is.
I agree with you. Later with Bob Costas, Studio 42, On the Record. What was your favorite talk show that you did for yourself?
I think Later is the one that I look back on with the most pride. And now in a YouTube era, people are constantly telling me that they came across this interview or that interview. And sometimes I remember it vividly, and other times I don't remember the particulars. But what I can say is that over the course of the 6 years that I did Later, we had a wonderful cross-section of guests, some lighthearted, some serious, from all walks of life. And it just had a different tone to it and a different texture to it than other talk shows, especially now. There's nothing like it now on network television, certainly. And it had an appreciative audience even then. And it's gratifying that when people come across it now, that there's still some appreciation for it. I left the show because there was so much else on my plate. At that time, I'm doing four Laters a week. There was no Friday show. I'm doing four of them a week, often taping all four and sometimes five in a single day. And there was also the NBA on NBC. I was also part of the football coverage. Mm-hmm. We'd just gotten baseball back. We were the network of the Olympics, and I was commuting between St. Louis and New York, because my kids were little and growing up in St. Louis. So something had to come off the plate, and I decided that Later would be the thing. But now in retrospect, I kind of regret that. I could have gone several more years doing it at, I think, a high level. And if I could turn back the clock, I might have made a different decision.
On the Record was so legendary that Ludacris mentioned you on his song, Hip Hop Quotables, from his album Chicken and Beer.
Well, I think he just needed a rhyme.
Yeah.
You know? So he needs something to rhyme with Rostis.
Yeah.
And it became On the Record with Bob Costas. But, that's right. You know, happy to have the boost to my street cred in any case.
You're also on a Mac Dre song, too.
You know, I haven't heard it. I've been told that's the case. And that one might be a little more profane than the Ludacris reference.
Yes, you are a part of the hip-hop culture because of all your references and well-respect because of your interviews. And just another call was the Derek Jeter call in 2014, his last game at Yankee Stadium when you were calling the games for the MLB Network, his RBI single to win that game, his last game at Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, another perfect scenario. What people may not remember about that is that the Yankees had a two-run lead maybe a 3-run lead, going to the top of the ninth against the Orioles. And Adam Jones, I think, and Steve Pierce homered for the Orioles, either two solos or a 2-run shot and a solo. In any case, it tied the game. David Robertson was on the mound, and he could not protect the lead. And as the second of those homers left the park, and I think it was Pierce that hit that one, and as he's rounding the bases, I said, if there's any upside in this for Yankee fans, it's this. Derek Jeter will be the third hitter now in the bottom of the ninth. So as it happens, the first batter reaches, and then Brett Gardner lays down a sacrifice bunt, and up comes Jeter. So a perfect scenario. And he delivers on the first pitch, a classic Jeter hit, inside-out swing, opposite field single, runner scores from second. That's the way it ends. People also may not remember that he played a little in the following games that ended the season on the weekend at Fenway Park, and actually an infield single against the Red Sox was his last at-bat. But for dramatic purposes and in the imagination, that's the end of Jeter's career, that base hit at Yankee Stadium in his home ballpark, walk-off hit, everybody going crazy, the crowd going nuts, his teammates embracing him, even the Oriole players remaining in the dugout and applauding. You know, it had all the elements, and I was just lucky enough to be there.
In what ways do you see the future of broadcasting in the near future? Because now with COVID-19, people are working remote from home. You have social media taking over right now, especially with YouTube. People are doing shows live on their YouTube channels. Where do you see the future of broadcasting going?
Well, it's going to look a lot different. It already does look a lot different. Mm-hmm. And even post-COVID, I think that a lot of broadcast entities, whether we're talking about covering live sports events or just news broadcasts, have discovered that you don't always need to have someone in a studio. You can Zoom someone up from almost anywhere. And you can save a lot of money in terms of covering events by doing them from a studio and not traveling an entire crew and having a production truck and all those sorts of things. So I think we will see some of that remain even post-COVID. But for the biggest events, you really do have to be there.
Yes,
you make use of whatever you can when the circumstances make it that way. So yeah, you can interview the managers and some players on a Zoom to prepare for a game, but there's nothing like being at practice. There's nothing like being, if you're talking about baseball, at the batting cage or in the clubhouse before the game or in the manager's office. That's where you pick up both important information and just little anecdotal tidbits that give the broadcast its texture. So I hope we never lose that.
What's something that you want to achieve left in your career that you haven't already?
I don't think it's anything that I haven't done. Mm-hmm. I just want the rest of my career, however long I decide to stay in it, to be confined to things that I really want to do, not things that I'm just assigned to do. Only the things that I most enjoy, and I think at this point most connect to who I am as a broadcaster. So the things I do on the Major League Baseball Network are certainly not seen by as many people as saw me on the Olympics or Sunday Night Football or whatever it may have been on NBC. But I know that everything I do for the Major League Baseball Network is in the bullseye for me, whether it's the games themselves or the historical pieces. And however large the audience is, they're appreciative of it. They tap into it. I'm a CNN contributor. Mm-hmm. That doesn't involve all that much. But when sports intersects with news, for example, when Tiger Woods had his recent automobile accident, I was on several times that day, and they hope that I can bring something to that based on my background that their regular news correspondents can't. So that's a small thing, but I enjoy doing it when it's appropriate for me to be part of their coverage. And if I do anything beyond that, it would involve long form interviews and some sort of commentary and journalism that, generally speaking, I'm not going to say it's always the case, but generally speaking, network television sports, for all the things it does extremely well, it's kind of lacking in that area. So the places where you can excel there are HBO, or although I'm not part of ESPN, there are certain niches at ESPN, E60, 30 for 30, whatever it might be, that tilt in that direction. Those are the sorts of things that I think I'm best suited to at this point in my career. There was a time when I was well-suited, and a long stretch, when I was well-suited to the big events. on NBC to the coverage of all the sports that they had, the Triple Crown horse races, the NBA during a wonderful era, baseball, football, the Olympics. And I'm glad I did it. It's an important part of my life. But at this point, I think I'm a better fit for smaller things, smaller venues, but things that connect perfectly to me.
And I'm glad that you are a part of CNN as a contributor, because I like the aspect of when they bring you in for sports, because not everything is all political now. Politics is the discussion. I feel as though if you bring sports to it, because back in the day, CNN and all these news networks, they weren't always focused solely on politics. There were other stories that they would cover as well. And I think them bringing you in gives them a change of scenery.
Yeah, the event has to, or the news item has to warrant it. Mm-hmm. But when there is that intersection, then maybe I can bring something that's a little bit different in content and perhaps in tone. Mm-hmm.
If there's any advice that you could give, Bob, to the students listening right now, especially in broadcasting or anyone who may listen to this interview, mm-hmm. that would be very important. I think they would value your advice greatly.
Well, Max, I would say get as well-rounded an education as you can, mm-hmm. and that education should not be confined to the classroom, although that's obviously very important. Be as well read as you can. And sometimes that means actually picking up a book, mm-hmm. not something that you find online. Actually getting away from the short attention span culture that has consumed us. And read a book. Read some of the classics. No matter what you wind up doing, even if you wind up as a sports broadcaster, the greater your frame of reference, the more interesting you'll be as a person and as a broadcaster. And the more widely read you are, the greater your appreciation of language. That doesn't mean you're going to copy what John Updike wrote, but your appreciation of words as you read increases. Your appreciation of how a well-constructed sentence reads and sounds, those things will seep in. It's not a matter of copying it. It's a matter of internalizing some of those rhythms and appreciation for a good turn of phrase or a well-expressed thought. Those things are very important. And then beyond that, I would say you need to get as much hands-on experience as you can. If you want to become a broadcaster, you've got one of the ways you've got to learn it, the most important way, is just by doing it. And there are some people who are very intelligent and very willing to work hard who just don't have the knack to be that effective on the air. Mm-hmm. The only way to find out is by doing it. And then if you do have that knack, you have to be honest with yourself. That's just the start. If you have that raw ability, you're going to have to get some reps in to hone it and refine it. So don't be too hard on yourself when you listen to your tapes for the first time and you don't sound the way you hope to one day sound. Yeah. And the other bit of advice I would give is don't expect that right out of school, no matter how well you've done academically, no matter how much ability you may have, that you're going to wind up anywhere close to your ultimate goal. Mm-hmm. Your ultimate goal is to be on ESPN or to be on network sports or to be doing the 6 or 11 o'clock sportscast in some major market. That's your ultimate goal. You still have to be willing to go to Tuscaloosa for your first job and to take whatever that job is. You know, you want to be a baseball broadcaster someday, but if the first job has you doing high school basketball somewhere and also doing weekend newscasts, go do that because all the reps will help you become better. And each step along the way, you're going to meet some people. You're going to network with people who will help you improve as a broadcaster and maybe who can help you somewhere along the way. So it's a process. Don't become discouraged or don't be so arrogant, on the other hand, as to think that after only a handful of years, you're going to be where Mike Tirico or Joe Buck or Jim Nance are. That's just not the way it works, at least not usually.
No. Yeah, you got to put in your work and then get to where you want to be. Bob Costas, I appreciate the advice, and I'm sure everyone also appreciates it who was listening. I want to thank you for calling into my show for an interview. It was a pleasure to be speaking with you here today. Is there anything else you would love to tell the audience? Any last words?
That'll do it.
That'll do.
This is not my eulogy, so I don't think I have to deliver last word.
No.
if anyone actually does deliver their own eulogy, which would be unique, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm not. Let's put it this way, Max. I'm not signing off, so I have no last word.
No. You're exactly
just so
right.
So long, and thank you for having me.
No problem. Thank you for everything that you did for the broadcasting industry, especially with sports and interviews. You're one of the greatest.
Thanks so much, Max. Take care. Thanks. Good luck.
You too. Take care.